Well, I'm James Franklin, the Vice President of the Australian Catholic Historical Society. I'll conduct the meeting on behalf of John Carmody, our President. Welcome especially to those who are joining us from very distant places. Now let me introduce the speaker. Oren O'Brien is the Archivist of the Archdiocese of Perth. He's completing a PhD at the University of Western Australia on relations between the Catholic Church and the Western Australian government during the mid-colonial period. He's also the author of a biography of a 19th century Bishop of Perth. As an ACH counsellor, he's helped us greatly to make the society truly national.
Thank you, Jim. Good afternoon, everybody. I've titled the presentation this afternoon, Catholic Archives,
Recording in Progress.
Are They History? And I've done that to try and provoke discussion. I'm not suggesting that Catholic archives are history in the sense that they won't continue into the future, but I think we're at a pivotal point in terms of how they progress into the future. And when I refer to Catholic archives, we're sort of focusing in today on diocesan archives, archives of religious orders and lay associations, parishes, schools, and also archives for public juridic entities. I've asked my PhD supervisor, Dr. Colin Barr, who's at the University of Aberdeen, to start off by giving us a global perspective on this issue. So we're a truly international presentation this afternoon because Colin's pre-recorded his contribution from Notre Dame in Indiana, where he's currently posted at the moment. And I'm here in Perth, and I would imagine that most of you are in New South Wales. So Colin will introduce himself. Colin was born in Canada, raised in Seattle. He received his master's and doctoral degrees from the University of Cambridge. He subsequently held academic appointments in Ireland, the United States, and since 2013, he's been based at the University of Aberdeen, where he's a senior lecturer in modern Irish history. Colin has published a number of books and articles on the history of Ireland and the Irish, and has been a visiting fellow at Sydney Sussex College in Cambridge and the University of Newcastle in Australia. He's a fellow of the Royal Historical Society, and his fifth book, Ireland's Empire, which was reviewed in the Society's journal last year by Jeff Kildee, is called Ireland's Empire, the Roman Catholic Church in the English-speaking world from 1829 to 1940, which has also been published by Cambridge University. And he does a number of regular appearances on CTV News in both Britain, Ireland and Canada. So I'll just share Colin's video with you now.
Good afternoon from South Bend, Indiana, where I am joining you from the Clingan Family Center for the Study of Modern Ireland here at the University of Notre Dame, which is my very generous host for the past 18 months or so and on into the spring. As I'm sure Oren will have told you when explaining who I am and why you're watching a video of me, I am normally based at the University of Aberdeen in Scotland, where among many other things, I have the great privilege to help out, I won't even go so far as say co-supervise, Oren's PhD thesis, the fruits of which I think many of you will have read in various journals, and there's much more to come. A hugely important project and one I'm very pleased to be involved with, however distantly. I'm also somewhat bittersweet in joining you in Perth today, and I guess across maybe Australia more widely, because in late March of 2000, I was scheduled to come to Perth and to Fremantle to launch my book, which I'll tell you about in a moment, and also to have the honor of giving the Monsignor Michael Keating a lecture. And as we all know, the world clamped down. That didn't happen. And in fact, it was, as you all remember, things went so very, very fast. It really wasn't a decision that I took until possibly the 17th, 18th, 19th of March, when it was clear to all concerned that if I got in, I might not have gotten out. All too true. So it is, as I say, both a great honor, but also a sadness to have to join you virtually still, 18 months or more on, because Australia and Australian Catholic history and Australian Catholic archives has played such an enormous role in my own recent professional career. In fact, not so recent. I first came to Australia around 2003, 2004 to work in the Sydney Archdiocesan Archives. And I've since then made perhaps as many as 10 trips. And although I don't have the number to hand, I think I must have been in 15 or 16 archives, most of which were ecclesiastical of one kind or another, although I never made it to Perth, although Oren very kindly sent me some material. So with all of that said, it's lovely to be seen by you, not to see you. And I hope very much that this can be something we do in person in the not too distant future, because I think it's so important for historical study of all kinds, not simply ecclesiastical history, but all kinds of history, that we are able to do things in person. We need to meet, we need to talk, we need to exchange ideas, and we need that personal contact that makes all of this possible and useful. So with that said, what I have been asked to talk about, and Oren will give you an in-person talk, either just before me or just after me. I know we discussed this a few days ago on Zoom, but I have forgotten. I'm nursing what they are calling the super cold, which has been brought back by all of our lovely students here at Notre Dame. And thankfully not COVID, but not an enormous amount of fun. So I will apologize in advance for any fuddle that you might detect. Probably it would be there anyway, but I'm going to use the excuse. So what Oren was going to talk about is much more of the practical matters, is how do we see the proper purpose and function of diocesan archives, the role of canon law in archives, the vision of the Perth diocesan archives, and so on and so forth, including some hugely exciting initiatives that he was sharing with me the other day, and is, I'm sure, are either known to you or he will be sharing with you as you watch or after you watch this video. My task is a slightly different one, to give you a global overview of how I see the situation. And that is necessarily impressionistic. It is my own personal opinion. There are any number of ways that you might disagree with me or add caveats, and I accept that completely. I suppose what gives me at least a small bit of license to even attempt a global survey is the book I mentioned that I was coming to Perth and Fremantle all those 18 months ago to launch, which actually published in late January of 2020, possibly the worst publishing date for a major book from the author's perspective that could have been chosen. But that book is called Ireland's Empire, A History of the Roman Catholic Church in the English-speaking World from 1829 to 1914. And in that book, I set out to do exactly what it says in the tin, is write a history of Catholicism in its Irish guise, or what I describe as a Hiberno-Roman Catholicism that straddled the globe, the United States, and much of the British world, and endures so recognizably even today, but certainly long, long into the 20th century. And I made various arguments in that book. I covered everything from the U.S. to Newfoundland, India, South Africa, English Canada, Australia, which was the, as Jeff Kilday kindly pointed out in a review in Australia, is by far the longest chapter because I really like going to Australia and I really like your archives. And finally, New Zealand. And in the course of this research, I wound up in, and again, I don't have the book here in front of me, embarrassingly, in my temporary office, but I think it was 104 archives in something like the 10 or 11 countries on five continents. In fact, six, if you count the Falkland Islands, where I received material in the post, from which I received material in the post as South America. So I've been in lots and lots and lots of archives, not in places like Brazil or France, although I've been to a few, or Germany. There are whole swaths of the Catholic historical world that my observations don't touch, although I will mention certain developments that I think are relevant to our discussion. So this is very much an English language or an English world survey. And with that in mind, I think I have at least some qualification to tell you what I think I found, what I think the challenges are and where, and how I think we might begin as a community, whether in Perth or in Australia or here in Notre Dame, or simply as a historical and ecclesial community globally, to meet that challenge. So in broad outlines, I found archives in every condition imaginable, from wonderful facilities, usually but not only in big dioceses with professional staff, sometimes two or three staff, wonderful copying facilities, scanning, catalog. I think of Baltimore, I think of Sydney, I think of several others around the world, where clearly there is no issue or risk at all of the safety of the archive or the future exploitation of the archive. In these big dioceses and some of the big religious orders, particularly those with headquarters in Rome, the issue around access is more going to be a question of release, of privacy, and of the challenges that flow from the various legal and other inquiries into clerical sex abuse and other scandals, which have brought, as we all know, the archival world very much into the purview and province of both the courts and the media. But that's a different thing. In that sense, those are issues that are not, as a historian, or at least not strictly speaking, my immediate concern. What I'm confident in is that big dioceses, I think Perth is another from what I've been talking to Oren about, is that in those places, we're okay. The collections are there. Sometimes there's massive gaps, but those are not now fillable. Bishops who liked fires, priests who wanted to fill it reputations, but that tends to be in the far back past. Nothing can be done. For these, I think the issues will be around things like digitization. Do you intend to put these online? For whom? How will you pay for it? And what future will that mean for the physical archives if we all go completely virtual? And not coincidentally, for the future of the archival profession, the memory of which and the continuity of which, as an historian, I think we cannot stress enough, and indeed the dedication in my book, Ireland's Empire, was to the archivists, because I think the Catholic archival profession, Catholic archivists or archivists who maintain Catholic records, is such an important one and such a underappreciated sometimes, including sometimes in big dioceses that do pay for these services and wonderful spaces and talented colleagues, that I think collectively we can't say often enough and loudly enough and in the right hearing how important actual archivists manning actual archives are. So digitization has an element with that, issues of cost, issues of access, issues of selection, but also issues of continuity of expertise, just to flag that. But broadly, we're okay. Now, where do I see problems? And I think I would flag these as being two or three, really, very specific areas. First, and perhaps most obviously, are smaller dioceses. The Brooms or Killalas, the Irish one, or South Bend, or wherever. Places that sometimes have long histories, particularly in places like Ireland, where the many dioceses, 27 or 28 at last count, far too many for the country, go back into the Middle Ages or beyond, that these places are suffering particularly from a shortage of clergy, a decline in donations, and this is likely only to get worse. If I look at Ireland, there is no sign that I'm aware of that the vocations crisis has leveled off, or if it has, it's leveled off at a level of vocation that suggests calamity is the inevitable result. And it is also the case that COVID has amplified the financial crisis in many of these small dioceses that lack endowments of their own. Put simply, when the people were not in the churches, they were not giving money to the same extent, and already stretched and strained finances fell further behind. And it is clear to me, and I understand why it would be, that in those circumstances, things like archives are going to be seen as a luxury. You can talk, as Oren will or has, about canon law and the obligations until we are blue in the face. And we will be told, yes, yes, it's important. We know we have to do this. But what that will mean is a couple of boxes under the staircase. And I remember, I won't say the name of the diocese, but one Irish diocese in particular, I found the archives an important 19th century archive, totally unused by scholars. It was literally living in a cupboard, Harry Potter style, under the bishop's staircase. They were perfectly happy for me to look at it, but they were distinctly surprised that anyone would want to. It took a lot of time and a lot of Kleenex as I just disturbed all of the dust. And I'm fairly sure that my allergies that I now enjoy so fulsomely every year, at least in part, derive from these sorts of archival experiences. So small diocese, what do we do about those? Well, yes, it's important to hit and hit and hit on the canonical obligation. That's fine. But also, I think we need to begin to consider, as places, I believe, like Perth and some other dioceses, consider the delicate negotiations of, and financial negotiations, but also of status, of sensitivities, of moving these collections into the care of larger diocesan centers, whether that's a Sydney or a Perth or New York or Chicago or what have you. That simply seems to me to be the inevitable reality. And I think we need to begin to think very seriously and very hard about how that will work given the individual circumstances of this small diocese or that small diocese. I think that's fairly straightforward. I think this is understood, although obviously not always welcome. Another area I think is more particularly at risk, and this is again the English-speaking world, is actually a quite obvious one, is poorer countries. I had the opportunity for my book to write a chapter on South Africa, and I got to go to South Africa, and I went to several Catholic archives, which were completely rich and full in Cape Town and in Port Elizabeth, but were almost astonishingly underused, despite the long history of Catholic engagement and opposition in some cases to apartheid and issues of great modern interest, let alone the long story of the Irish in the Cape. And I remember in Port Elizabeth, the bishop, late bishop at that time, well, it wasn't late at that time, he became late soon after, tragically, but the bishop coming in and basically wanting to have a look at the historian who was in his archive, because he never had one before in his many years in that diocese. In one sense, that's an issue of education, is I would hope that my book and other people who have worked subsequently would see, oh, well, there's a rich archive there, I should go, and that will serve to drive, as it were, historical traffic, and that will be fine. But more particularly is what I realized in South Africa and later conversations that I've had is that vast chunks of Catholic South Africa, there are or were archives surviving of great historical importance that are simply going to be in the skip or the bin if they're not there already. The issues around completion of religious communities are, of course, applied there as well, although often not as pressingly so, but simply an issue of resources, of awareness, and of knowledge. So there is, if I had a magic wand and a significant donor, I would start a pilot project in some place like South Africa or Zimbabwe or Nigeria, take your pick, and do a deep dive survey. What is out there? Where is it held? What condition is it in? And do a triage. Is it safe for now? Is it safe for the next week? Or is it going in the bin later today? And start to try and take action on that basis. The final area, again, is something that's no surprise to anybody, and that's religious communities of both men and women. I think we need to also bear in mind the men. And I think I myself am guilty of this, is I've been involved in a number of projects trying to identify and preserve the archives of women religious, particularly smaller communities. And I think that work is crucially important for a variety of reasons, which I don't think I need to articulate to this group. But some of the smaller communities of men can get left behind. Partly this is because there is a reluctance sometimes on the part of surviving members about what might be found. I think we can all think of examples of that. But also because there were a significant number of small groups, often diocese-based, that never took any particular size, have now either reached completion or will do soon, and lack the resources and international networks to preserve and disseminate their archives. And these collections, and often these groups had enormously important roles in schools and social provision, in hospitals, and so on, that are of enormous interest, not just to the Catholic community of these places, but to the larger historical community or the national community, places like Australia or Canada or America. And I think these are getting lost. I think they are getting lost rapidly. So we need to remember the men. But with women religious, we see sort of a bifurcation. As so many communities grapple with that horrible word completion, larger ones that are better resourced and better prepared, particularly those with an international reach, I'm thinking of the Sisters of Mercy or some of the Dominican congregations and so on, are making preparations. They are endowing trusts. They are creating heritage centers. I know there's one being created in Australia or has been created in Australia. There's a similar one in North Carolina in the U.S., both run by the Mercy Sisters. There's one being a great one in Dublin, in Baga Street, at the Mother House. And I think the danger for these is that they have the longer-term resources to survive and to perpetuate their mission. And that's something I think we will all have to look for and to look towards and be aware of. But ultimately, they are safe for now. They are in professional hands. They are there to be used. There is an awareness of the issue. It's smaller diocesan-based communities, service orders above all, who were originally created to look after hospitals or priest houses or seminaries, and then spread out into all kinds of social services, usually among the most marginalized of society and drawing off of the most marginalized of society, including indigenous communities. Those are at intense risk. They are at immediate risk. So where does this leave us? I should wrap up. I think we have to think in a model of an investment mix. And I choose that example very deliberately, because this is ultimately about money, is how do we resource? How do we create an appropriate mix to preserve the important and crucial and threatened records of the Catholic Church across the English-speaking world for posterity, both historical and ecclesial? So I would say there are probably three main solutions, each of which do have a model available to point to. I've alluded to two of the three already. The first is the big dioceses, the Perths, the Baltimores, the Chicagos, the Londons, Dublin, and so on. And that is primarily an issue of convincing well-resourced large dioceses that archives matter, pushing the canon law argument, pushing the cultural engagement argument, pushing the heritage argument. I think that is probably the safest strand, probably the one that requires least attention, but not no attention. There are going to be dioceses and there are going to be bishops, and I'm quite confident you've all thought of at least two, as I said that are not going to buy that even though they have the resources of the scale, would quite happily say it's just a bunch of old paper, bug it under the stairs. They exist. We need to combat that. The second model is the idea of an independent trust, or one endowed by a religious community, those of the Sisters of Mercy and others. I think these are going to have to be taken on a case-by-case basis. Some are fantastic and well-resourced and endowed with a clear professional agenda of preservation, catalog, and appropriate access over time. I think as a profession, on both sides, as it were, of the historical and archival fence, we would be well advised to create models of best practice, to share those, not simply within the same country. I know Australia has an amazing group of church archivists who talk together all the time. And in fact, I think Australia is miles in advance of almost every other jurisdiction in this way, in the English-speaking world anyway. But I think there's going to be a need to share that knowledge, not just across Australia or across America, but between those two. And then in particularly so, to identify, assist, and sometimes even take on board those smaller communities that might be looking for a place to rest their archives, who are facing completion. Maybe they do have the resources, but they don't have the experience or knowledge of how to go about this. How are they going to achieve this end? I think we as a profession need to be proactive in identifying these groups, offering them advice, whether through web portals or something similar, and helping them to achieve this kind of independent status. And then finally, there is what I think of as sort of the big bang solution. And the model here is KDOC in Belgium, my one non-English speaking reference. And I'm sure many of you are familiar with this, where the KDOC model essentially build a large building, ultimately probably several, climate control, and be willing to take in all Catholic archives that come, with the caveat that they have to come with at least some money. At a minimum, they will be taken in, stabilized, and preserved, and as resources become available, cataloged and made available. This is not ideal. Things could sit for many, many years, potentially for decades, until they became available to scholars. But this is an arc. And that's the model I think of. It is an arc. Is we take stuff in, we stabilize it, and we work and wait until we can use it. KDOC is doing that for Belgium, and I think is extending its remit a bit, although I'm not sure of the details on that. And that has inspired a similar effort in the United States, which grew out of a 2018 conference at Boston College, which I had the privilege to attend, which has led to Boston College, the American Jesuit University, founding something called the Catholic Religious Archives Repository, which on the face of it looks like a KDOC for the United States. It may very well develop into that. I hope it does. But there is a genuine risk that it will be under-resourced or dependent upon the interests of one particular university administration. And as those change, as they do over time, interests and priorities and university policies and preferences will naturally change with it. I'm sure those archives, when succession, will be safe and preserved, but it may not be the case that it will continue to be a repository or an ark. And in any event, taking in the entirety of the scope of at-risk Catholic archives across just the United States is probably far beyond the reach even of a single KDOC-style operation, whether in Boston or anywhere else. That also is true of institutional repositories such as Notre Dame, where I'm based at the moment, which has a very large collection of Catholic material, but that is not one that can be expanded infinitely. The University of Dayton in Ohio, not that far down the road from here, is similarly building these collections, as are several others. But these will be small and regional ones. They are not equipped and they are not intended to go out and find that small order of male religious in Topeka or that small order of female religious in Southern Florida and to take their archives, help them understand what they have to do with their archives, bring them in, stabilize them, catalog them, preserve them, and make them accessible in due course. So it's not a council of despair, I think, so much as one of urgency and a plea for connection. Paradoxically, the Catholic Church, and it's there in the word, the universality of the Catholic Church has not permeated its historical or archival context as well as it might. The lines tend to run from Australia or America or to Rome. And there's all sorts of reasons for that, and I talk about them in various publications. But I think in archival terms, we have to consider, we have to divide somehow. So the English language world is as good as any. There are others that are possible. But working laterally, not just up to Rome, but across Australia to New Zealand to America to Canada to so on. And in that, to be proactive and conscious for those groups and regions that are better prepared or better resourced or more advanced down this road, to reach out and contact those in countries or in communities that we have reason to suspect are not, and offer them, if only our friendship and our advice, even if we have no money to give, we can at least make contact and say, we are here, we have dealt with some of these challenges, we are dealing with some of these challenges, and we have a common set of aims. I think that would be an enormous benefit, and it would allow projects like a KDOC of the Antipodes, or two or three KDOC-style setups in the United States, maybe Boston College is one and others, and new trusts, and private benefactions, and more institutions taking an interest, that would probably preserve a great deal of what there is to preserve, because the quantity is vast. Even those 104 archives that I visited in all those places, I know I only scratched the surface. I left box after box after box unopened or barely skimmed. There are whole topics and areas of social history, women's history, history of Catholic relations with indigenous peoples, and so on and so forth, racial history, that has simply been not ignored, is unknown. And that material, when it's safe, we found eventually. But when it's not safe, when it's still out in small communities, when it's under a bishop's staircase, that is a desperate situation. So that's my global tour. Hopefully not too depressing. I hope it is a lovely, what would it be? Late spring day in Perth. It's getting cold here in the Northern Hemisphere. I wish very much I was there with you in person. I hope very much to be with you in person sometime again. I think this is the longest I have been absent from Australia at a single stretch since my first visit in the early 2000s. I miss it terribly. I look forward very, very much to seeing you all again in better circumstances and in happier times. Thank you so very, very much.
Colin's given us a really good global view of what's happening with Catholic archives. I'm going to try and now bring us back down to the national and even the diocesan level. So when I was appointed to Perth Archives in 2016, it was interesting Colin talked about the fact that large urban dioceses are probably the best equipped for archives. And I think that is true in terms of resources. But resources, having resources doesn't always translate into having great archives. I think that there does need to be a certain amount of planning around that. And certainly when I was appointed in 2016, the archives was in physically good condition in the sense that a large amount of the archives were centrally located and all and housed correctly in the environmental conditions. But we were in the wake of the Royal Commission, or the Royal Commission was still actually in the final stages. The redress scheme followed shortly after. In Perth, there was a failed collaboration between the diocese and the religious orders to build a provincial archive. It got to the point of financial discussions and then just fell apart. So there were a whole series of religious orders, as Colin said, nearing completion and getting desperate in the fact that they were unsure what they were going to do with their archives and how they were going to ensure their legacy in the long term. In addition to that, there were pressures within the diocese to digitise records, to develop a plan for all of the records that were being created digitally as well within the administration. So there were, you know, three or four pressures for me in providing a direction forward over the next five or so years. So I started to put some thought and do some research. My background is as a historian, not as an archivist, and I think that's been to my benefit over the last 5 years, because immediately my reaction was, well, I need to do some research on why are we keeping these archives and what are the requirements that the church has set for archives. I was fortunate enough 12 months after being appointed to be able to go to Rome. The Irish Society for Church Archives was organising a tour of religious archives in Rome, so I was able to see the Vatican Secret Archives, the English College, Franciscans, Propaganda Fide, and that gave me some insight into the great tradition of keeping archives within the church. So that is the front of the Vatican Secret Archives, which interestingly has just been renamed the private archives, because essentially that is what the purpose of the secret was meant to be. And I think that the name has led to a lot of confusion in the past, and hence it was renamed, I think, last year or the year before. So what does the church say about keeping archives? Well, Pope St. Paul VI made an address to ecclesiastical archivists in September 1963, and he said, "It is Christ who acts in history and who writes his own history, so that our records are echoes and traces of his passing through the world. And so to have respect for these records, documents and archives ultimately means to have respect for Christ and to have a sense of the church, and to provide ourselves and those who will come after us with the history of this period of the Lord's passing through the world." So really broad vision there about what's the purpose for keeping archives. So then there's another publication for managing diocesan archives and records, which says something similar. Its key objective, which it highlights at the beginning, is that to understand the importance of archives and records, one only needs to look at the past and plan for the future. In Catholic archives around the world, researchers use primary source documents to tell the history of the Catholic Church. The Vatican, Propaganda Fide, and dioceses worldwide hold the story of who we are as followers of Christ, Without these fundamental pillars of knowledge, we would be unable to tell the story of how the saints, martyrs, and evangelists shape the lives of the faithful. So primarily, it is about telling the story of our community. And then there are a whole series of other reasons why we keep archives. So as a community of believers, we keep archives to record that story of our life as a faith community. Beyond that, canon law has created regulations that require us to maintain archives. I won't go into those in detail, but I still think, nonetheless, they're worth looking at some of the major points because it's quite interesting what canon law requires. So canon law requires that dioceses and parishes protect their records with the greatest care. The curia are to create a safe place, which is called the diocesan archive for the storage of their records, which pertain to the spiritual and temporal affairs of the diocese. They're to create inventories. The archives are to be kept locked and opened with the permission of the bishop and the chancellor. People are not permitted to remove documents without the consent of the curia. The diocesan curia are also meant to keep a secret archive. And again, when we're talking about secret archive, we're talking about a private archive of the curia. And similarly, there's safeguards around how that should be managed. And then it goes on to talk about the types of things that should be in an archive, acts and various other official documents, registers and so on. And then it also says that a diocesan bishop is to take care to create a historical archive, which contains historically valuable documents which are diligently protected. So the last regulation there, I think, gives a pretty broad remit for what archives should be doing. And I think depending on the archivist in diocesan archives, they can either take that last canon as an opportunity, and I think it ties into what Colin was saying. You can say, well, part of our remit is to look after those records that are of historic value and that tell the story of the Catholic community within our province, and that allows you, I think, to make an argument to have broad collections. Now, of course, there's all sorts of resources, considerations within that, which often prevent archivists from taking in collections and keep them on a fairly narrow scope. So then in addition to canon law, there's all sorts of civil law regulations that we're required to keep records for, the Corporations Act, etc. Interestingly, in Australia in 1869, the Provincial Council actually made a series of decrees requiring diocesan bishops to keep archives. So there's a long tradition within Australia of focusing on the importance of keeping records. And I think that the Royal Commission, in its findings, noted the Catholic Church was pretty good at keeping records. One of the issues was that when it didn't have records, and this is one of the things that I've had to focus on, not such an interesting task, but one I've been required to undertake nonetheless, is that if dioceses dispose of records, they need to be disposing of that according to the relevant legislation and according to due process. And I think that's where the Catholic Church came unstuck in the Royal Commission. Where it didn't have records, it wasn't able to demonstrate why it didn't have those records. So in terms of Perth archives, to use that as a bit of a case study, we started off, as most diocesan archives do, in the Bishop's House. And quite interestingly, I was listening to Colin describe the boxes under the staircase. The archives was originally located in Chapter Hall, and there were many records stored under the staircase. So that is actually a reality. And they were wrapped in brown paper and stored in boxes under the staircase. So it started off in 1992, becoming an official archives. And we were lucky that a lady called Sister Frances Divy, who sadly passed away last year, spent 20 years dedicating her time to creating a professional archive. And she did a wonderful job. And she had a broad vision of what that would contain. And so when they renovated the bishop's house in 2008, we were lucky that she organised for the archives to be located in a new facility that was designed by herself and the State Records Office, and it's got climate control and security and access control and all of those sorts of things that you'd expect in a professional archive. There were a series of policies that she also created about what the archive should acquire and what our mission was. And I'll just read you the very short introduction to that. So she's following that same sort of line as Pope St. Paul and others, where she says that the Christian religious tradition is closely bound with the support and encouragement of scholarship, which seeks sincerely for the truth, founded on an historical understanding of the life of Jesus Christ and informed by the tradition of the Church. Catholics are prompted by Scripture and the Second Vatican Council to discern the signs of the time. And then she goes on to talk about the types of records you'd expect to see in our collection. By the time that I'd come along, Sister Frances had retired and there'd been a couple of short-term archivists, a series of short-term archivists, and to some extent the vision that she had come to a pause. And so there was a need for me to do some reflection and build on her original vision to bring the archives into the 21st century. So linking into what Colin said, I had a sense that if we wanted to gain the funding and support broadly for the archive to continue into the future and to be able to not only collect the diocesan records but other records in the archdiocese that I was aware needed housing and urgently, I thought we're going to have a really broad statement for the archives. So we've got a very short mission statement, which is about 6 dot points, and basically it starts off by saying that our mission is to preserve and make available sacramental records and cultural heritage objects of the Archdiocese, to capture the records which document the mission, programs and service of the Archdiocese, to promote a consistent approach to the management of information and records, to facilitate accountability, transparency and collaboration, to serve the Church by using digital technology to provide access to reliable and quality information and records, to develop programs which are a holistic collaboration and coordination of people, processes and technology, and to provide the highest quality of service within our resources and to walk in service with our community. Again, lots of broad terms. I think the key for the survival of archives is openness and collaboration. So just continuing on with a couple of the themes that, that Colin mentioned, I think that collaboration is quite significant in terms of the future of the archive. So I was over here in Perth trying to develop a mission for our own archives and aware of religious orders that wanted to deposit their collection somewhere for safekeeping. And I really felt the need to link up with other diocesan archivists. Now, Brian Lucas had a very forward vision in creating the Catholic Diocesan Archives of Australia Committee Group, which is attached to the Australian Catholic Bishops Conference. Now, over time, that group is very strong. It's a great group, but it had focused very much on the different... When it was rotating through the diocese, it was beginning to focus on what individual dioceses were doing as opposed to trying to create a vision for all of the archives across the country. And increasingly in the last couple of years, it's gone back to that central vision of trying to create a vision for archives across the country. And in fact, now we're actually breaking up and having regional meetings as well to support those dioceses. And it was interesting, in one of the first regional meetings we had, which ties in again to what Colin was saying, a couple of the regional archivists said, look, we can barely keep our own archives going, let alone consider bringing in religious orders that are coming to completion within the diocese. We don't have we've barely got enough resources to pay our priests. We certainly don't have the funds to be investing in heavily in our archives. By the end of that discussion, I think what had become apparent is that the only way that everybody was going to move forward was sharing, collaborating. And I think sometimes that's not the Catholic Church, I think if we're fair, can be quite territorial at times. And I think that the main point that came out of that discussion is the need to break down some of those barriers for those dioceses that had more resources and skills and capability to share those skills, capability and resources with the smaller dioceses, but also for the smaller dioceses to be open to that help, to be open to the fact that they may at some point have to move some of their archives over to the larger diocese to accept help and to share their own knowledge. And I think that is probably one of the key points that I wanted to finish on. I think that there is, like Colin said, great hope for Catholic archives into the future. But I think sharing and collaboration is the only way that it's going to move. We're going to move forward collectively, and it's not just going to be urban dioceses or large religious orders that have excellent collections and others are just left to survive or perish. So, like Colin, I think I'm hopeful for the future of church archives. I think that they contain history, but they're not destined to become history.
Thanks, Oren. Thank you. Very helpful. Now it's time for some questions. So Howard Murray has a question.
Thanks, Jim, and thanks, Oren, for an illuminating presentation on the role of archives. I sympathise certainly with your comments about the Royal Commission's views about the Church not being entirely adequate in its record-keeping in the professional standards arena. I was the Director of Professional Standards and involved in diocesan professional standards work for nearly 20 years, and I sympathise and know exactly what you're talking about. But I was interested in a recent article in the UK journal History Today. The September edition talks about faking it and the validity of archives. In your research, have you come across any significant instances where records have been deliberately altered or, on the other side of the ledger, deliberately falsified, not so much documents being removed but additional documents being supplied to present a more pleasant picture of whatever the situation might have been?
It's interesting you say that. Look, I've got two examples. One, actually, I've just noticed I skipped over, which I was going to share. So I've got an example where of a collection being sanitised and an example of additional records being added. In terms of the collection being sanitised, a religious order that decided to deposit their archives with us about 4 years ago, it's taken us about 3.5 years to negotiate the transfer of their records to the diocesan archives. And I was really surprised at how complex it became over the series of discussions. One of the things was that a lot of the records were straightforward, the property and some historical records, and there was no great discussion over those. But the particular set of records that became quite complex was the chapter minutes, because they contain all sorts of discussions amongst the leadership team about individuals within the order. I think it was more that than their strategic discussions that they were concerned about. And they were concerned about these minutes going as far back into the 19th century. There was one sister who'd come over from Ireland. She'd been sent out to the middle of nowhere and had essentially, I think, a mental breakdown. And there was great records in the chapter minutes about how they dealt with that. And then I think ultimately, unfortunately, in the 19th century, she ended up in a lunatic asylum because they just didn't have any other place or facility to place her in. And the order was initially saying, look, I don't think we're going to deposit the chapter minutes with the diocesan archives. We're going to keep those and we'll decide in the future what we're going to do with them. So there was just a sense of not knowing how they were going to really tackle this. And I found it really strange. They felt that the fact that this sister had had a mental breakdown and ended up in a lunatic asylum was something to be really was a shameful thing. Now, from my point of view, I think that's not shameful at all. I think it demonstrates the great difficulty that these women faced. And I think it's an essential part of their story. And I don't think you want to sanitize that or, you know, separate that from the archives so that you're only telling part of the story. Because I think it makes it richer rather than actually takes away from their story. So eventually I managed to get them to agree to transfer those chapter minutes with a caveat that they'd only be opened at 100 years after their final entry. In terms of adding or falsifying the records, we've got a funny story. It's not particularly controversial, but Archbishop Prendeville, who one of our past archbishops, there was some question about where early bishops were buried in the cathedral. He went up to the sanctuary one night with a rod, put it down through the bottom of the sanctuary, hit something solid and said, right, that's where our bishops are buried, wrote an official letter, which he placed in the archives, saying, this is where the bishops are buried. Now, we found out years later that they weren't buried anywhere close to the sanctuary, and it took a great deal of time and resources to find out where they were. That's probably the only falsified record that I've seen in the archives.
Thanks, Aaron.
Thanks. Anne Toming has a question.
Oh, thank you. And Howard and Aaron, thank you for that, the question and the responses. It reminded me of I had the opportunity of going to the Central Rome archives, and the first thing I was told is that they were all sanitised because once World War II ended, they got stuck into the archives and cleaned them out quite nicely. So unlike Britain, who was had lots of their archives bombed, the Italians apparently, I hear, actually quite consciously removed some of them. Oren, the question I really have is that intersection between like council and state records and church records. I know in some jurisdictions where, for example, the Book of the Dead, from the church registers or registries is actually lodged within government archives. I don't know, you know, much about that. Are you able to talk a little bit more about that and what how that intersection works?
Yeah, look, I think that Colin made the point that there's no one solution for how we go forward with archives, and that in some cases, so one of the orders that's placed their records with us, in another province they've lodged them with the local history centre, and in another province they've lodged them with the university. So depending on the local circumstances, they've taken different approaches. I think religious orders ultimately, in my opinion, should be aiming to deposit their records with the diocesan archives because there's that same sense of mission and purpose. Once they place them in the hands of a secular entity, I think there's all sorts of issues that can develop. Similarly with universities. Now, maybe if it's a Catholic university, it's slightly different, but if it's a state university, I mean, the universities objective is to exploit the records for research projects and funding. So basically the archives, there's a real emphasis on the archives having to earn their keep. And I think that I know that there are several instances in in Britain, where that has become quite problematic. So I think that, that should be a last resort, you know, only when there are no other options should they be deposited with a state library or... and the other thing, of course, is that state entities have very different access frameworks than Catholic archives. For example, with the National Archives, records become available after 30 years. Now, in sacramental registers, there's often very confidential information included, and you wouldn't necessarily, I don't think, want that becoming publicly accessible after 30 years.
Could I just quickly ask another question, Jim? Yep. I'll butt in. I was interested in Colin's take, the comment he made about the richness of the documents he didn't actually have a chance to unwrap, social history and women's history. And it just sort of made me wonder a little bit about the role of historians in general, like not necessarily religious historians, but other historians, to really appreciate the gold mine that is actually there in a lot of religious history archives.
Look, I think that people like Colin have a huge role in the future of these archives, because they are great advocates. I think that it's a double-edged sword, though. Colin deals with these archives critically, but with a great sense of church history and, you know, the context surrounding that. At the moment, there is a lot of research going into modern slavery, and missions with Indigenous people are being looked at in that framework. I won't go into the historical argument about whether that's accurate or what. I suppose that it's probably somewhere in the middle and different for each mission. I think you just have to be, that has to be considered carefully. I think there has to be a framework about how the historians can use the collection.
Thank you.
Yeah, if I could ask a bit further in that connection, is about whether who has a right to access those things, and in what circumstances, and who should be paying for them. I mean, as I'm sure we all know, one of the big positives about researching Australian history in recent years is the digitisation of Catholic newspapers by Trove, which of course the church didn't pay anything for and is a benefit to Catholic history. Now, something like archdiocesan archives that you're dealing with are of course really owned by the church, and fair enough. But with something like those 18th century Irish archives of minor dioceses, or something like Broome 100 years ago, the church authorities were almost the only people recording anything in those regions. So they're very valuable for general history of those regions. I wonder, for those rather distant things in time, how we could negotiate and maybe money in and access out, so to speak, so that, for general historians.
And I don't think... I think if I... again, use sort of Perth as a case study. Once we start looking at a period of time such as the 19th century, I really don't have an issue with, I don't think it's really relevant what historian is accessing it, in the sense that, you know, there's such a distance of time, I think it can be publicly available. But the issue within diocesan archives, as you suggest, Jim, is resources. Whilst all of those records are housed correctly and so on, they need conservation work, and probably they need to be digitised to make them accessible. And if it's done properly, because you only want to do something like that once, you don't want to be digitising things multiple times, there is a cost associated with that. So I think that, for example, we had a university approach us, and I think they were a bit vexed with me by the end of the negotiation, but they said, look, we'd like access to a portion of your 19th century records. And I said, fantastic, that's a great opportunity for us, great opportunity for you. I said, right, so, you know, what funding do you have to digitise the records? Oh, no, we'll need you to digitise the records and deliver them to us, and then we'll research them. Now,
reasonable.
It was of no advantage to us. All it was going to do is cut into our limited resources. So I think that if researchers, and speaking to the other archivists, I think often they do have research proposals which are of little benefit to them. I think if, and I know in Ireland, you know, universities come to some of these diocesan archives with considerable funding in hand. I think if people are going to diocesan archives with practical proposals that are of benefit to them, and I think you'll see a lot more cooperation.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks. John Carmody was going to say something.
Thanks, Jim. Of course, you're between the devil and the deep blue sea, Oren, in that you've got to be all things to all researchers, and you can't possibly know any more than any of the rest of us can about what researchers of the future are going to do. And yet you can't keep all the records. So people are going to be disappointed from time to time, irrespective of who's done all the paying. But I just wanted to add one point to the discussion that you had at the beginning with Howard about sanitising all the rest of it. When I was doing the entry on Sidney Bishop Thomas Muldoon for the Australian Dictionary of Biography, I was told, first of all, by the archivist that there was no file on Bishop Muldoon at all, and that seemed very unlikely. My theory is that it was probably shot off to the secret archives in the Vatican for safekeeping, as it were, or secrecy or whatever. When I spoke to them, they told me that they couldn't possibly help me because they dealt with records pontificate by pontificate, and 20 years ago they're still dealing with the pontificate before Pius XII, I think, so I didn't think there was much chance of getting it. Eventually I decided that part of my solution was to look at the archives of Cardinal Gilroy, and so I wrote to the Cardinal and said, you're a historian, you understand the importance of access, and he said, yes, I agree, and instructed the archivist to let me have access to Cardinal Gilroy's papers. This prompted a call from the office of the Chancellor, one of the younger researchers there, to say they were aware of this instruction, but they weren't going to carry it out because they knew I was going to do damage to the church. And I said, well, all I'm trying to do is to get information about the bishop. And they said, no, we know your secret aspiration is to do damage to the church. And so if George hadn't intervened and said, I've given Dr. Carmody that right, so bloody well do it, I wouldn't have had any access to it at all. So there are all sorts of people who get believe that it's their prerogative to override even the ordinary in the diocese.
Well, I think that maybe a more diplomatic approach would have been the one that Brenda Nile records in her biography of Mannix, where she was given access to the diocesan archives, and clearly the archivist at the time didn't agree with this. So she arrived with he or she, I don't know who it was some years ago, arrived with two manila folders with Christmas cards in it. So
I saw a lot of those too, because a lot of people used to write Christmas cards or birthday cards to the Cardinal or birthday cards to his mother, and they were all preserved as well. So I didn't get as much as I'd hoped by looking at his papers, but I did get access. When George cracked the whip, they jumped eventually. But there was an example of censorship at a lower level where this would be true in the nomenclature of the Soviet Union as well, and the Chinese Communist Party, I'm sure, people acting to protect the good name. And of course, that reminds me of the open-endedness of the use of archives. Who would have thought 50 years ago that a royal commission would want to look at Catholic Church archives, or courts for that matter? So there's no limit to the archives, and you can only second guess what you think it will be, can't you?
Yeah, but I think if we're working towards we're working really hard with the religious orders to try and get them to keep their archives locally and to deposit them with us. I think at least the records are kept local and available. That, you know, you set yourself up in a pretty good position for researchers to be able to come in and do fulsome research in the future.
Thanks. I think it's time to wind up at this stage. So many thanks to Oren and, of course, Colin for that valuable insight into how archives work and the problems of keeping them into the future. That's it for this year for the Society as well. Please join us in 2022 when we hope to be able to stream some of the live talks elsewhere. That's being investigated at the moment. So, Dr. Carmody, would you like to farewell everybody for the year?
Well, thank you all very much for your loyalty and support in difficult times. There is a complete program which has been assembled on the assumption, my assumption and the parish office at St. Patrick's, that we will be meeting face-to-face, and I'm sure that everybody in Sydney who's able to get to those will be very glad of that. I hope that people find an interesting and challenging and varied program. It's been had its usual difficulties and frustrations in setting it up, but this society would not work without the aid-dedicated work of the Council of the Society, so I'd like to put on record my own appreciation of that, but also without the loyal support of its members, and we want to broaden that as much as possible with the streaming if we can get it to work. But in the meantime, thank you to everybody who's a member of the Society, supports us in all sorts of ways, but particularly your presence at events like this. So happy Christmas, and let's all have a happy and safe and healthy 2022.
Thank you.
We've been listening to a podcast of the Australian Catholic Historical Society's third monthly meeting by Zoom, held on the 14th of November 2021. Dr. Oren O'Brien, Archdiocesan Archivist, Perth, Western Australia, and Dr. Colin Barr, School of Divinity, History, Philosophy and Art History, University of Aberdeen, Scotland, addressed the significance of Catholic archives for the study and understanding of history. The speakers were introduced by the Society's Vice President, Professor James Franklin, who also moderated the discussion which followed. ACHS President Dr. John Carmody concluded the meeting. This podcast was produced for the Society by me, John Kenny. We'll be back with more history in the new year.